Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Tori Collins, and he'll be answering your most important questions on the Housatonic River on trout and smallies. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Tori a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Tori Collins about the Housatonic River and its trout and smallmouth bass. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Well, before we introduce Tori, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have two chances to win in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Tori's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners of those prizes at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a dozen of Tori's top trout smallmouth bass flies, and he's told me that there will be a few special flies in that box that are not in the bins at the fly shop. So those are some secret flies, I'm sure. So here's how you win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question's going to be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen carefully and use your best typing skills at the end of the show. Tonight, our guest is Tori Collins. Tori was born and raised in Connecticut and has been fly fishing for 30 years. He caught his first trout, a wild brookie, at age 4 on a garden worm that had somehow managed to loop itself over a tree branch and dangle in the water. Tori started, that sounds like creative casting to me, that's for sure. Tori started fly fishing at age 14 and was a fanatic by age 20. He discovered the Housatonic River nestled in the northwest corner of Connecticut in the Litchfield County Hills over 23 years ago, and it's been a nonstop love affair ever since. Tori has managed the Housatonic River Outfitters for the past 8 years and guided on the Housatonic and Farmington Rivers prior to that. He's worked in the fly fishing industry in many capacities over the years, including working as a technical advisor for Orvis in Manchester, Vermont, as a casting instructor for Sage, Orvis, and others. He's done commercial fly tying and has been a professional fishing guide in both Connecticut and New York. Tori's pursuit of trout has taken him all over Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Vermont, as well as western states such as Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, and Utah, and down south to Tennessee and Arkansas. Trout are his favorite species, but anything with fins that swims is fair game. Although Tori fishes by and enjoys all disciplines, from dries to wets to streamers, his personal favorite is nymphing, and he especially loves to target big trout. In the past year, he has experimented extensively with the Euro-style nymphing, including Czech, Polish, French, and Spanish, and is rapidly becoming a convert to it. Tori, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, Roger. Glad to be here.
Well, glad to have you. It's going to be a fun night tonight to talk about some West Coast, East Coast fishing here. And we'll get to that in a minute, folks. But we're going to try to cover the primarily Connecticut, part of the Connecticut area where the Housatonic goes through. And Tori's going to explain all this to us because there's quite a big fishery there. It encompasses a lot of different kinds of fishing, so he's going to enlighten us on that. And we're going to try to pull out of Tori some of his special strategies and techniques for presentation, both for trout and for smallmouth. So, Tori, I'm counting on you to give up some of those secrets you've been hiding all these years. Okay?
I will do my best.
All right. Well, in our conversations before the show, you described the Housatonic as a Western-style river out east. So could you explain what you mean by that and kind of just give us a lay of the land of the Housatonic River from start to finish, its topology, you know, the type of water there and the wide variation that you might experience there?
Sure. There is a lot in common with the Housatonic and a lot of Western rivers. As a matter of fact, if you could transplant the river out west, it would look very much at home. The only thing that really gives it away is when you see those rolling hills of the Northeast in the background. It's a good sized river in the section in the northwest of corner of Connecticut where we fish it the most, where the fly shop's located that I manage and where there's a 10-mile catch and release stretch. It probably averages over 100 feet across. I'd say 100 to 200 feet. There's spots where it's over 100 yards. And there's a lot of structure. There's a lot of bugs. There's a lot of big bugs. Unlike a lot of eastern rivers where you got to fish a lot of small flies, a lot of times you can fish the big stuff on the Housatonic. It produces some big trout. It's very fertile. We get very good growth rates. And it fishes in many, many ways like a western river, a lot of the same tactics. It's a big enough river to put a drift boat on or take a raft down and do it western style. You know, when the water's up, you can pound the banks with big streamers and you can fish big nymphs. And a lot of times we get to fish some pretty big dry flies, too. I mean, small flies certainly have their moments on there, too, but it's very similar to a lot of western freestone rivers.
Now, it starts up where, in Massachusetts?
Yeah, well north of the Connecticut-Mass border. There's three branches. There's an east, a west, and a middle. And they come together to form the main stem. Then it flows through Mass for waves. There's two catch-and-release areas up in Mass, one in Lee, right where it bisects the Mass Turnpike, which is, you know, Interstate 90. And that's about a six-mile-long one. And parts of it go right through the town of Lee. You know, it's not urban, but it's like kind of a suburban stream in that section. Although when you get in the stream, you kind of forget and don't notice that there's stores and what in the background. And then there's another shorter stretch not far from that called Glendale. It's a mile. And then eventually it flows into Connecticut. The gradient drops. It's more of a smallmouth, pike, carp. And it goes into Connecticut. Then eventually it picks up gradient again. And there's a 10-mile catch and release section that starts in the towns of Falls, Village, Cornwall, and flows back down through Sharon into Cornwall Bridge and also through the town of West Cornwall, and that's about 10 miles long. And that's the section the Housatonic's probably most famous for. And then, probably more than a handful of years ago, they added in a second lower catch-and-release area called the Bulls Bridge catch-and-release area that's about 2.5 miles long, and that's about maybe 15 miles south of that. Those sections I just mentioned, the two catch-and-release areas, have quite a few trout, browns, rainbows, probably more browns than rainbows, and an abundant population of smallmouth. The Housatonic is a very, very underrated smallmouth fishery. It's prolific. You know, guys that have fished around the country in a lot of smallmouth fisheries say that, you know, they've never seen a smallmouth river with so many smallmouth in it.
Now, Terry Connolly in Ware, Massachusetts, wants to know, are you fishing when you're fishing the Housatonic and when you guide there, are you fishing in Connecticut or Massachusetts?
We do most of our fishing and guiding in Connecticut, of course, partly just geography because that's where we are. But, I mean, that's where there's that 10-mile catch and release. You know, it fishes well. I do dabble a little bit up in Massachusetts if I want a little change of scenery. It fishes well up in Mass. It fishes well in Connecticut. It's a little bit different river up there. It's smaller. It's about half the size up there.
So this 10-mile stretch is the primary area that
you... That's the section the Housatonic is probably best known for.
And that 10 miles, that's a good float, too. That's a nice float for a day of getting out fishing.
Yeah, the typical float we would do is about maybe 6 miles, but there's different floats you can do. There's different ways you can break it up.
Okay. Now, we have a couple of questions from Alan Branford in Connecticut and John Wright in New Jersey. Both ask about the natural flow. Can you explain what the natural flow is and how it's affected the Housatonic?
Sure. I need to give you a little background on the fishery to explain what the whole natural flow thing is. They put in a dam at Falls Village. Oh, I couldn't tell you the exact date, but I think it was near the year 1900. And for most of the 20th century, they manipulated the river up and down. And if there was a high flow, they didn't have any ability to hold water back. It's a very small impoundment. It's a shallow pond. It's a top release. It's not a tailwater in the sense that you might think of it. And they did this for eons, and it became apparent over the years that that was not healthy for the river and the fish and the insects and the crayfish. And one of the things that was happening was in the summer the river gets warm. It's a trout fishery in the spring and the fall, usually in July and August, maybe starting in late June, July. We switch over to smallmouth because the river warms up, and the trout are able to hold over by finding spring holes, and there's numerous tributaries that dump in cold water, and they will migrate to those, and they're actually protected in those under the current regulations in the summertime from June 15th through the end of August. You can't fish within the signs that are posted around the tributary mouths for 100 feet from the signs. So they used to manipulate the flow up and down, and they just accumulated a lot of data indicating that it wasn't good for the fishery. So they implemented about five and a half years ago, it became natural flow, which means that whatever comes into the dam is what they run out. And it's kind of been interesting because a whole bunch of stuff is going on and we're still in a state of transition. It'll probably be decades before we see exactly what's going to happen because hatches and things like that change very slowly. I was talking to, I think it was Tom Ames or somebody like that, one of those bug experts. He said it takes a long time to see all the changes. Some of the changes, it's definitely better for the fish and the bugs. I've seen some hatches, especially the blue-winged olives, increase. It seems like there's more crayfish. It seems like there's more scuds. The river flows through a lot of limestone geology, so it buffers the pH. And unlike a lot of freestone-type streams, we actually have a lot of scuds in it, sort of like you'd find in a spring creek, and a lot of crayfish, too. Before, they would run the water typically low in the morning and low in the evening. And when I say low, I mean like a shutdown flow. It was leakage from the dam. And a lot of guys would sink their fishing to that. They'd come out and fish in the morning, and then they'd either knock off for the day when he came up, or they'd take a siesta, and then he'd come back in the evening and fish the evening hatch. And under natural flow, they don't raise and lower it like that. So some of these old-timers, it screwed them up a little bit. Some people are having a hard time making an adjustment. The guys that are flexible are still doing fine. Now you can fish all day with no interruption in your fishing. It used to be you'd be fishing, maybe a nice caddis hatch, it's in May, a nice caddis hatch is starting, you got some fish working at it, you're doing well. The next thing you know, all the rocks start disappearing, the fish stop rising, and it's over. That doesn't happen now. The Housatonic tends to be a murky river, and it still gets murky after rain. It flows through a long watershed and a lot of farmland. I've noticed that the water's clearer, and it seems to clear up a little quicker. It's still, a little murky compared to an average trout stream, but it's definitely clearer. It's a lot more natural now, because you don't have them yanking the water up and down. The fish can set up shop in one location, and they're not constantly getting pushed in and out of different lives every day multiple times. Overall, it's definitely been a good thing.
Now, did you say that dam was strictly flood control, or is it the
highest dam? No, they generate power from it, actually.
Oh, they do? Okay.
Not a lot, but they do generate power from the dam, yep.
Okay. Now, are there other dams upstream from that river? I mean, from that dam?
There are dams up in Mass. Yeah, I think that is I believe that's the northernmost dam. There's five dams total on Connecticut on its way to the Sound. I mean, as you go down the river, there's some huge impoundments way downstream from us. So it makes some pretty good-sized lakes that have some pretty good fisheries for primarily warm water fish. And as you go down below the lowermost dam, they get actually everything there. They have a phenomenal striped bass fishery that goes all winter down below the lowermost dam, Derby Dam. They get shad. They get, and once in a while, they get a sea-run brown. One of the rivers that dumps into it below the dam, the Naugatuck, gets broodstock Atlantic salmon stocked by the state that can range up to 20, 30-plus pounds. And some of those fish work their way down into it and end up below the dam. So it's an interesting fishery. From the beginning to the end, there is just about every kind of fish that you find in Connecticut exists somewhere in the river.
But up where you are, with the exception of this one dam we've been talking about, which is now pretty much natural flow. It could just as well be a log jam, I suppose, in there as far as nature is concerned.
Right.
So it's pretty much a natural stream up there then. And like you said, it's not a big enough dam to create a tailwater there. So pretty much, you know, it's the way it was many years ago.
In many ways, yeah, that's true. It's definitely in a more natural state now. I mean, I'm happy that natural flow went through. I never thought I'd see this happen. You know, FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, licenses dams typically for 30 to 50 years, and it was coming up for relicensing. And this was a process that was in the works for 10 years. And the definitive point was they proved that the water releases were violating water quality standards.
Interesting. So you said basically you've seen an improvement in bug life, and there's been no adverse effect on the fish themselves. If not, they've gotten better because of
No. I mean, I've heard, you know, various things from some people. Some people like it. Some people, you know, are always unhappy when changes are made because that means you can't go out. You don't have that predictable low window of low water in the early morning and in the evening. So some people like that. You know, that, of course, would concentrate the fish into a very small area and, you know, create some more dry fly opportunities.
But what about the health of the fish? That's what I'm talking about.
The fish are as healthy as ever. You know, if not more so. The Housatonic is just amazing. I mean, it's a stock trout fishery that produces a significant amount of holdovers. There's a few wild trout in there, but it's not a significant part of the population. And that's more so in some of the little tributaries that flow into it. We're definitely dependent on the stocking, like most streams in the Northeast. To answer the changes in the way they're running the river, the state has completed some run-of-river survey data, and I'm very excited. In 2009, they're totally revamping their management paradigm they've been using for the last about 25-plus years. They're going to double up the number of fish they're stocking, because essentially now you're fishing the river. It's a bigger river when you fish it now. Because it's natural flow. You're not fishing it during a shutdown. So they've doubled up. They used to put in 9,000 trout in that 10-mile section, and now they've doubled up to 18,000. They're starting to stock rainbow trout again this year in the catch and release area, which they haven't done in a long time. They've just been doing brown trout, and which is good because the rainbow trout absolutely thrive in the Housatonic. It's just amazingly fertile. You know, some streams I've fished, you flip rocks, you see a few bugs. You flip rocks in the Housie, you see a lot of bugs. I mean, we have just about every hatch. As I mentioned, we have scuds, we have tons of crayfish, we have minnows, helgramites, big stoneflies, big mayflies. It's a very fertile river with a perfect pH. It's got a cobbled bottom that makes for a bazillion places for the bugs to live. It makes a lot of holding lies for the trout. It also makes the wading a little tougher, too. It's definitely the kind of wader river that I'd recommend bringing a wading staff if you have one.
Now, you've mentioned browns, rainbows, and smallmouth in this 10-mile section?
Yes.
Okay. Are there any other fish that you might target in that section?
In that same section also, there's pike. And there's also carp, and I'm seeing a growing interest in those in the last few years. They typically, the pike and the carp typically inhabit the lower gradient, slower, deeper sections.
Okay. Now, Carl Butler in Lombard, Illinois wants to know, are the browns and smallies in the same areas on the Housatonic, or do they inhabit different areas of the river?
They do overlap a lot. A lot of it is most dependent on water temperatures, I find. When the river warms up, the trout fishing shuts down if it gets real hot in the summer, and then you're just catching smallmouth. There's certain shoulder months like June and September when you can catch both because the water temperature is on that cusp where it's warm enough to get the smallmouth active, but it's not so warm that the trout aren't. On those shoulder months, if I want to target smallmouth, I'll typically do something like throw big streamers. And usually the smallmouth jump all over those before the trout can even think about it. And if I wanted to target trout, say, in June, I'd probably fish the faster water at the heads of the pools where there's a little more oxygen, and the trout are tending to hold there more and less so for the smallmouth. But, yeah, a lot of the same flies and tactics do work for both. I mean, on the average, smallmouth like a little less current. You know, they like the water a little warmer. They like less gradient, and they prefer bigger food forms. It'll also hit some pretty gaudy colors. You know, like I find if you go with a color like chartreuse, you'll tend to catch almost all smallmouth.
Chartreuse works everywhere, Tori.
I tell you, it does. It's sometimes it's actually
an island to Siberia.
Probably. Sometimes it's actually good. It actually can work well for trout too. But if the water is at all warm enough that the smallmouth are active, the smallmouth will jump on it almost every time before a trout has a chance to grab it. They just that's my favorite color in a streamer for smallmouth.
Well, it sounds like the fishing can kind of move around then, depending on what you're targeting with the temperature. But Hank Susie in Rhode Island wants to know, what stretch of the Housatonic do you consider the best for smallmouth fishing?
Boy, that's a hard one to answer. There's so many – I mean, the whole river that I'm familiar with has smallmouth in it, you know, from north of the Connecticut-Mass border. I haven't really fished that the slower, steeper sections there, but I've seen pictures of some big smallmouth out of there. It fishes well above the dam in Falls Village. If you put a boat in there for smallmouth and you get some bigger ones, it fishes well for smallmouth in the section, the catch and release area, more so in the summer when the water warms up. It's a smallmouth management area below the catch and release area. To be honest, there really isn't a bad section. I mean, if you go way downriver as you start getting toward New Milford, which is below the next TMA down is in the Bulls Bridge TMA, and this is below that, you can start getting into New Milford, and eventually dumps into another impoundment, which is Lake Winona. It seems to be that there's some big smallmouth down there, and I suspect they migrate up out of the impoundment in the spring, I mean, with spawning urges, and they summer over, and then when it gets cold in the fall, I think they migrate back.
Joe Wright in New Jersey asks about, do you need to get below? And he says trout conservation area. Is he talking about the trout management?
I think, New Jersey, they call catch and release areas and special management areas trout conservation areas. Okay. No, you don't have to at all. They are literally present everywhere in the river.
Okay. A question from Tom Murray in Pooler, Georgia. How far above and below the dam do you fish? How often and which do you prefer and why?
Well, I guess I probably log the most time in the catch and release area, which is below the dam. You got about 2 miles of open, non-regulated, just normal Connecticut fishing regulation water below the dam. And then you've got roughly 10 miles of catch and release area, which is where I do probably the majority of my trout fishing on the Housatonic. But I do fish down below it quite a bit. There's about... there's probably about 8 miles of prime trout water below it, going down toward the town of Kent, and then eventually it becomes very slow and deep, and smallmouth dominate in that section, and there's pike and carp and even a few largemouth, and eventually hit the impoundment where Bulls Bridge is, and there's another catch and release area below that. So I probably spend more time below the dam, but I also, sometimes I venture up above the dam. A friend took me up above there in a boat last fall, and we had really good fishing for pike and smallmouth and largemouth. And sometimes I venture up to Massachusetts, way up there, a few times a year, just for a little change of scenery.
Sounds like a lot of fishing to be done there.
Oh, my God.
Well, when we return, we'll be talking more with Tori about fly fishing for trout, smallmouth bass, and a lot of other things on the Housatonic. The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call Platte River Fly Shop at 1-307-237-5997. That's 1-307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tori Collins about the Housatonic River, and we're talking about trout and smallies. If you'd like to ask Tori a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, before we jump back into the fishing here, Tori, I always ask our guests, what are you doing in the fly fishing world nowadays? Tell us about your job and any other fly fishing related activities you're involved in.
Well, I manage Housatonic River Outfitters. I've been there for about 8 years managing it, and I guided for the shop a couple of years before that. And that takes up quite a bit of my time, as you might imagine, probably 50, 60 hours a week. And I update our website. Our website is dryflies.com. I update the river report pretty much every day on the Housatonic. I also update some of the other fisheries too, like the Farmington, that are near us. We also have a nonprofit called Friends of the Housatonic that we started with three objectives. We actually privately stock rainbow trout below the catch and release area, and we sell raffle tickets and take donations. And people can, you know, this is a write-off if people want to make a donation because we are a nonprofit. And we also look for any projects or anything that we could do to enhance the fishery. And also we're involved with the Connecticut DEP's program called No Child Left Inside, where they try to get urban kids out into the country and doing outdoor activities like fishing. So we donate equipment and our guide service and things like that. One of our guides, Aaron Jasper, has a website called troutpredator.com, and I'm pretty involved in that with him. The meat of that site is the forum. It's all about sharing information to hopefully help you catch more trout and be a better fisherman. There's definitely a little bit of a nymphing bias. A lot of us are big nymphers. A lot of us have gotten into the Czech and the Euro nymphing in the last year and gotten pretty serious about it. And we probably have some of the best information on the internet on that subject, period, on that site. I think we've got a thread that's up to 14 pages on Czech/Euro nymphing. We've got great information on fishing reports, and we've got Davey Watton posting on there. He's probably maybe the best living wet fly fisherman in the world. So we have some great threads on wet flies. So it's a really good website. Another group that has a good website related to the Housatonic is the Housatonic Fly Fishermen's Association. Their site is hffa.net, and they're sort of the watchdog group on the Housatonic, and they're one of the big reasons we have a catch and release area on the river. When they discovered PCBs in the river that General Electric put in through manufacturing from the, geez, I think starting in the 30s or 40s, right through the 70s, the state stopped stocking the river, I think, in 1980, and the Housatonic Fly Fishermen's Association took them to court, and they got them to start stocking it again, but they created what was then, I think, the second catch-and-release area in Connecticut. And so they're a great group and a great organization, and we have a good rapport with them.
Great, great. Well, sounds like you're active and definitely in tune with the Housatonic in a lot of different ways. That's great.
We try.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, we've got a couple of questions. One on the that came in on the internet here, Camilo Santana in Westford, Mass. Someone coming to the Housatonic River for the first time, where are some of the easiest access points? And I guess we better narrow our focus here to, you know, the area that you fish primarily, because from this point on. So
one of the strong points of the Housatonic as a fishery in the east is access is fantastic. There's some rivers that are good fisheries, but the access is difficult, like the Delaware River system. Like, if you don't know where to access that, it can be tough. The Housatonic is the complete opposite of that. The access is fantastic. That 10-mile catch-and-release section, there's a covered bridge that bisects it roughly in the middle, and from the bottom up to the covered bridge, you have pull-offs probably every quarter mile to half mile. And in most cases, you can see the river from the pull-off, and even if you can't, if there's a parking spot, I guarantee there's a path where within 100 to 200 yards, it leads you down to a good spot. And then once you get up to the covered bridge, if you cross over that, that's Route 128. If you were to cross over that and then go about 100 yards, you take your second left on River Road, you have pretty good access to the river for about another 2.5-3 miles of good access and good trout water. The upper part of the catch and release area, I'd say the upper 3 miles, you kind of need a boat of some sort. It's slow, deep, low gradient, drops off very quickly off the banks, and it tends to be more smallmouth type water, and you get carp and some pike in there also, not so much trout.
Now, another kind of follow-up question on that, Gregory Horwitz in South Windsor, Connecticut, says, I'm a perpetual novice. Perpetual, that's interesting. I fish the Willimantic,
yep.
Yeah, river. However, I'd like to hit the Hoosie. I'd like to fish alone, and I'm comfortable with small streams. What is the best time to fish it, and where can I get to where there isn't a lot of fishing pressure? And maybe you can discuss fishing pressure if there is or isn't, and when it is and when it isn't.
The Housatonic is a lot less crowded than a lot of the other high-quality northeastern trout streams I've fished. It's a big river. It can soak up a lot of pressure. At prime time, if the water conditions are good, then it's prime time and the weather's nice. Certain spots can get crowded just like on any stream that's accessible in the east. However, having said that, you can virtually always get away from the crowds if you're willing to do a little walking. Like I said, it's usually limited to, you know, a handful of more popular accessible pools with easy access where you can basically park and walk 100 feet and be fishing. If you're willing to do a little walking in between the pools, you can usually find some solitude. If you go in the pocket water, you can typically find solitude. If you venture outside of the catch and release area, the pressure drops off dramatically. And if the upper catch and release area, the 10-mile one, is crowded, you can always drive down to the one at Bulls Bridge, which is about 15 miles south, and that one gets a fraction of the pressure.
Okay, good to know. A couple other questions came in on the Internet. One, we've been talking about smallmouth. How big, in that area that we've been talking about, these two catch and release areas, what's a good trophy smallmouth, what size do they get in that area?
Well, you know, a lot of that depends on what you're throwing for flies. If you're trout fishing and you're catching smallmouth incidentally, you might consider them a nuisance.
Right.
Because in that particular case, you might find the average 4 to 8 inches. However, if you go out targeting them with the proper flies, especially when the water temps are proper, you might find the average all of a sudden jumps up to the 10 to 14 inch range, and the bigger fish might be pushing 16, 17, 18 is, in the catch and release section, would be a very large smallmouth.
Okay.
I have heard of and seen bigger fish caught near than that, but that's pretty much a top-end fish in that section. I've heard of much bigger fish than that getting caught occasionally as you go way downriver. And again, like I said, I suspect some of those bigger smallmouth run up out of Lake Winona,
right,
and hang out in the river for a good chunk of the season. And I think that's where some of those, you know, 4, 5, 6 pounders come from. If you use bigger flies, you will catch far bigger smallmouth. I like to, when I'm targeting the smallmouth, I like to throw streamers that are at least 4 inches long. And I'll still get the occasional dinker, but, you know, you don't get too many fish that are under, you know, 8 or 10 inches when you do that, and the average size starts to jump up, you know, bigger than that.
Yeah, yeah. Chris in New Jersey wants to know, did the smallmouth have any kind of negative effect on the wild trout propagation?
You know, the smallmouth don't really seem to have any much negative effect on the trout. They seem to kind of cohabitate okay, and a lot of times it seems like in the summer when it heats up, the trout will vacate. They'll migrate through the cold waters, and all of a sudden you're catching smallmouth where you'd be catching trout. Because I know somebody asked a question earlier about do they, you know, inhabit different areas, and yes and no. You know, sometimes they inhabit the same areas, and sometimes they inhabit different areas. We've speculated that sometimes they've stocked some fairly small trout in the spring, and sometimes they put them in right in April, right about when the river's starting to crack 50, right when the smallmouth are coming out of a almost hibernation state. And I wouldn't be surprised if they eat some of the smaller trout that they stock in the spring. There's not a lot in the way of wild trout in the river. Once in a while, I catch a trout I think might be wild. If you go up in the little tributaries that dump in, that's more common to you know, see trout that appear to be wild. And I think any wild trout that are in there are fish that are moving in and out from the tributaries.
Mark in Wisconsin, this is off the Internet as well, wanted to know if there's any crappie in
You know, I have actually caught a very few crappie in the sections that I trout fish, but I know there are crappie in some of the impounded sections of the river, you know, further downstream.
Okay. Now, what kind of, and we'll be getting into some strategies and flies here in just a minute, but what kind of equipment do you recommend if you're going to come and fish these two areas, fishing for smallmouth and primarily trout? Give us a rundown on what you'd recommend for rods, reels, line, terminal tackle.
Well, just like a Western river, probably a 9 foot five weight is your standard rod. If you wanted one rod that'll do everything for trout, I use anywhere from a 3 weight to about a 6 weight for the trout. I guess probably if I'm specifically streamer fishing, I'd probably grab a 6 weight. If I'm nymphing, I'm typically using 4s and 5s. And if I'm fishing dries, my go-to rod would be a 4 weight, but anywhere from a 3 to a 5 will do for the dries. For smallmouth, it would depend on what size flies you're throwing. A lot of guys use their same trout rods, and as long as you're not throwing real big flies, you know, a 5 weight would be fine. I'd say probably a 6 or a 7 weight. You could probably go even as heavy as an 8 if you're throwing really big stuff or you're throwing, you know, really wind-resistant poppers.
So you're saying the size is mainly dependent on on the flies you're throwing and not the size of the fish you're catching, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. Now, what about lines? Are you primarily using floating lines, or is there any need for intermediate or sinking lines in the river?
Primarily floating lines, certainly, obviously for the dry flies, for the nymphing, usually floating lines. For the streamers, we'll often use a teeny type line, you know, an integrated shooting head, anywhere from 130 to 200 grains, maybe on occasion even as much as 300 if the river's really ripping.
What kind of terminal tackle do you use when you're fishing for streamers?
In terms of tippet sizes, and if I'm using a sinking type line, you usually use a leader no more than 4 feet long, and typically a pretty heavy tippet. It's going to depend on what size flies you're throwing. Like, typically when I fish streamers, I'm looking for big fish, so that means I'm throwing big flies, and that means I'm using a heavy tippet. I usually put on the heaviest tippet I have in my vest, which is usually about 0X. I would never go any lighter than about 2 or 3X for throwing streamers. There's just no need. You're just going to donate flies to the fish and to the bottom. And if you're throwing big streamers and you're stripping them fast, you could even go heavier than 0X.
Yeah, because they're not going to see the leader.
No, you're not trying to dead drift it either.
Yeah.
They're usually focused on your fly. Sometimes I use a floating line. It would depend on the flow. Let's say the flow was down and I'm fishing in early in the season and the water's cold. If I use a 200 grain line, I'd have to strip it too fast to keep it from hanging bottom. So in that case, I might go to a teeny 130 or a shorter sink tip, or I might just use maybe an 8 to 10 foot leader and either a weighted fly or maybe pinch a split shot above it. And you know, I might throw it across stream and just throw an upstream men to get it down and then just let it do a slow swing.
I know you're going to talk more in a few minutes. We're going to talk about some European nymphing techniques and so forth, and I know you said earlier there's quite a difference there in terminal tackle. So when we talk about nymphing, maybe you can address those, you know,
sure,
those things as well. Quick question on, you had mentioned already, you know, that you might want a wading staff or something. Is there any other equipment that you would suggest bringing, clothing, wading soles, you know, staff, that kind of thing?
The river is slippery and the bottom is cobbled. Ideally, I like studded wading shoes. And to tell you the truth, the majority of the wading shoes we sell are studded. I would prefer stocking foot with wading shoes over boot foot, just because it will give you better traction, better footing, better ankle support, and there's less drag on your leg because they fit tighter around your ankle. A wading staff is definitely a good idea. I like a, you know, folding one's nice, so when you're done with it, you can just tuck it in its case in your belt and not have it getting tangled up in your fly line. You know, clothing just, you know, appropriate to the season.
What about watercraft? You had mentioned drift boats and rafts.
It's a very floatable river. If you have a flow of at least about 800 CFS, which is cubic feet per second, you can get a hard boat in it. A couple of guys that guide on the river will do it at less than that, and you can see the scars on your boat to prove it.
Yeah.
We do the majority of our guiding out of rafts because you can float it at lower flows, and you're more flexible on your put-ins and take-outs. You could certainly float it. You could probably float it down to 600. You have to get out and walk in a few spots in the trout sections. So there's sections you can float it in the summer when the flow is typically lower than that for smallmouth. You can float it right down to, geez, probably about 200 CFS for smallmouth, depending on what section you do it in.
Mm-hmm. This is a question off the Internet as well. Rod Thornton in New Jersey says, can you say a few words about fishing the Housatonic from a kayak? He's interested in fishing for smallmouth from a kayak. Is that a doable thing? And
you certainly could. I mean, the river is very popular with kayakers and canoers. You do see a lot of different types of boats going down the river. There's a, you know, there's an outfit on the river that rents canoes and kayaks and rafts and shuttles people. I've never fished it out of a kayak, but you certainly could, and I do occasionally see people fishing out of kayaks.
Another question off the Internet. George Miller in New Hartford, Connecticut wants to know, what's the best river flows for wading, if you're going to be wading?
The best river flows for wading, I would say anything from, say, 1,200 CFS down is probably the most wading-friendly flows. You can wade the river up to, say, I don't know, we usually put 2,000 as the upper limit per cutoff for wading. I mean, that would be high, and it would depend on the water clarity, but you can start to get in the river. You can poke around the edges a little bit at that flow.
We've got a lot of great questions coming in here from our audience. Another one, Camilo Santana, Westford, Mass. I'm a minimalist fisher. Sandals and shorts, would I be comfortable, or is the water too cold, and is there a need for waders?
It would depend on the time of year. I mean, the Housatonic does tend to run warm. That would depend on your own personal tolerance. You know, starting in May when the weather gets milder, you could probably start to wet wade if you're tough, and certainly by June, usually in the summer, we do tend to wet wade it. Though, I mean, the one thing about the whole sandals thing is the bottom is pretty cobbled. You might bang up your feet pretty good on the bottom.
You
might want to go with
stuff too, I mean.
Yeah, usually when we wet wade it, we do wear, you know, wading shoes.
Okay, well, Tori, we need to take a quick break again, but when we come back, we're going to talk about some flies and some strategies and get into some real fishing here. So, at Housatonic River Outfitters, we offer the finest in fly fishing in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. We have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with our guides. In addition to spectacular trout fishing, we offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing guide trips for warm water species. Please tour our website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services we offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. We are the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and we have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tori Collins about the Housatonic River. And we're talking about trout and smallies. So if you'd like to ask Tori a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, good. Let's talk about some flies, because we've got a lot of questions here, Tori, on flies. Kevin Kritzner in Wilson, Wyoming, says he used to live in Brookfield, Connecticut, and he snuck up there when he got some time. Could you please explain the major hatches by season, and please include flies and sizes to cover those hatches?
Well, all right. Well, this one may take a few minutes.
Though. Yeah.
The Housatonic is very fertile with that limestone geology it flows through. It's got that perfect pH for bugs. So we get almost all that major hatches and a lot of minor hatches and a few hatches that actually most rivers don't get that we're famous for. I mean, right now we're starting to see some of the early season stones, the early black stones. I would say the real first main event, though, is the Hendrickson, which typically starts in the latter part of April. If you made me pick a date, I'd say probably, you know, somewhere. Opening day is the third Saturday in April in Connecticut, although the catch and release areas are like this are open year-round. Usually it's just after opening day. I've seen it as early as the last few days of March on a mild winter, and I've seen it as late as the end of April. But usually somewhere around the 20th, 22nd would be a good starting date. That is definitely a super hatch, and it probably is the best hatch to catch a really big holdover trout in daylight. You know, that's a hatch you got a shot at getting a 20-incher on a dry fly. And the really glamour event with that is if you can catch a spinner fall in the evening. Now, if it's windy, wet, or really cold, the spinners will hold off, and they won't. And a lot of times they'll fall mid-morning the next day. And that's a lot of guys don't even know that, and they're not even out before noon, so they miss out on that. But the spinner fall really big, so it brings the big fish up because they can't get away, and they're not competing with nymphs or anything else. So all the food's located in one spot, and the big fish just come up and sip it in. It's really an event if you catch it. They typically about a size 12. Be the most common size, maybe a 14. I've seen them as big as a 10. But if I had to pick one size, I'd say a 12.
That's a nice meal for those trout.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. Usually in sometime around maybe the 5th or 10th of May, we start seeing what we call the green caddis. Some people might call it the Mother's Day caddis. It's actually not the same caddis as they get out west that they call a Mother's Day. That's like what they call a granum. They get that in the Catskills and Pennsylvania. This is actually Tom Ames identified it for us. It's a Hydropsyche species, which is the most common of all the caddis, and it's a green-bodied version. And that probably averages about a 16. They can be as big as a 14, as small as an 18. And we get a profusion of caddis in the month of May. I tend to think of May as the caddis month. It also tends to be a month when I catch some of my biggest fish, actually. often on caddis, a deep drifted caddis pupa, like a LaFontaine sparkle pupa in like a 14 or 16. And first we see the green to olive-bodied caddis. They're actually bright green right when they first hatch, and then if you were to look at them a few hours later, their bodies darken up to more of an olive. So for a pupa imitation, you'd use something in green, and for to imitate the adult, when they come back an egg lay later in the day, you'd want to use an olive-bodied fly for the adult. And again, for the pupa green, if you deep drift a pupa in the mornings, I've caught a lot of really big trout doing that. It's very exciting fishing because the fish push up in the heads of the pools. Just after the caddis start, we start seeing some March brown slash gray foxes. I see the entomologists have renamed that into one hatch, and they just consider them all March browns now. They're pretty good size. They're about a 10, maybe a 12 on the small end. And those will hatch sporadically from about mid-May. You'll see those well into June. Early to mid-June, and you'll get spinner falls from them in the evening.
Before you move on into the seasons, we had a question, and it kind of goes back to float trips. But Bill in Connecticut wants to know when you begin, and since you were just talking about the spring, when you can begin guide float trips in the spring. When do you guys start that?
Well, we'll pretty much do it whenever anybody wants. You know, we're going to be doing some floats in the next week or two, actually. I would say, you know, prime time to float the river is April, May, June. The only thing that can be a little dicey with June is as you get into June, the water temps may heat up. It's usually doable for trout at least through mid-June and sometimes right into early July. And then the other thing is sometimes the water gets too low to float in the trout sections. So May is a great month that usually has great temps and good water levels. And April, you always have enough water in April. Well, sometimes you have too much water, but April is another very good month to float the river.
Okay. So continuing on from June on the hatches then?
All right. So we have the gray foxes, March browns. You'll also see some betas in about an 18 or 20 in May. And actually, since we've gone to natural flow, it seems like the betas hatches have really increased on the river, both in the spring and in the olives we get in the fall. You start seeing the sulfurs around May 20th, give or take a little. They're about a 16, and you'll get sulfurs and sulfur-type mayflies right through late June. We do see a few green drakes. I wouldn't call it a super hatch. There have been probably two nights I've hit that when it was just absolutely crazy. And, of course, one of those nights I didn't have my green drake box with me, and I brought it back the next night. Roger, I didn't see a single green drake the next night.
They know that. They knew you didn't have them.
I understand it used to be a super hatch, and there was a massive flood in the 50s that apparently blew so much silt out that it just wiped out the nymphs. We also get brown drakes. That's a short-lived hatch that usually occurs for maybe 4 or 5 days in early to mid-June. If you catch it right, that is truly a super hatch. It's a spinner fall is the real main event with that, and that happens right at dusk. They do that weird dipping up and down in the air thing. It's very easy to tell that it's a brown drake once you've seen them, and you'll never mistake them for anything else. It's a big bug. They're probably about a size 8, 2X long. And when I've caught that right, that's another one that drives the big fish crazy when those spinners end up on the water. You start seeing light Cahill sometime in that late May, early June time period. I call anything with a cream body a light Cahill. You'll see those from a 12 to an 18 with probably a 14, but the most common size from, like I said, probably early June straight through the summer into at least through September.
You know, Tori, you mentioned several times now spinner falls as being really important. And I just want to let the listeners know that we did a show with Kelly Gallup on spinners and cripples and did the whole show on just spinners and cripples.
He did a book on that.
Yeah, and he did a book. And I was just amazed at how much there was to all that, you know, that is a type of fishing that a lot of people ignore, don't know anything about, and just miss it totally.
I'll tell you, if you don't fish the spinner falls on the Housatonic, you're missing out. I would have to say, as far as the big trout I've caught on dry flies, I've caught the majority of them. In fact, I'd say the vast majority on spinners. Spinners are floating flush in the film. They can't get away, and the big trout know it, and they just sip them in. In fact, I'll tell you this. Always debarb your spinner patterns because it's such a confident take. They just suck it in, and they're usually hooked way in the back of the mouth. But the spinner falls provide, in my opinion, some of the best dry fly fishing on the river. I particularly like that, like mid to late May through mid to late June time period. You know, a lot of times I'm working a little bit late in the shop. I can still go out, have a snack after work, throw on my waders, and I can go fish the evening hatch in a spinner fall. And many is the night I'm there till 11 or 12 at night. You know, I position myself so I can use the glare to my advantage. And, you know, in the dark, you can get within a rod's length of the fish. And, you know, I'm fishing dry flies in the dark and, you know, hooking large trout sometimes on these spinners and in other patterns too. As you get through June, usually the river starts to warm up as we get into July and August. And actually, oh, there's another major hatch that starts in June. Usually, maybe around June 10th, they call it the alders, it's actually not a true alder fly. It's a zebra caddis would be the more correct common name. And that is definitely a super hatch. It can last for 6 weeks. It can start in early June and go as late July. It's a big caddis. The wings on it are probably a size 10. The body's probably a 14. Usually you're fishing a size 10 or 12 imitation. They have antennas three times the length of the wings, and they have zebra-like markings on the back. It's sort of a tan and dark brown to black. And they're kind of an olive green when they hatch on their belly, and then they darken up to a black to brown color. And that provides a lot of really good dry fly fishing if the river isn't too warm. If we get a cool summer, it can just be superb. And they will actually hang out in the alders. And that's how they got the name. The bad part is there's an old bug that was named by the English called an alder fly. It's a totally different bug that's not a caddis. And it creates confusion with people. It is actually a caddis. And like I said, it's more properly called a zebra caddis. And that's when you can blind fish near the banks. You know, if you go into some pocket water sections that just has some water, it doesn't even have to be that deep, but just deep enough to hold fish, you can blind fish out and do quite well. And sometimes you'll catch big trout on those. It's a big mouthful. They get used to seeing it every day. As we get into the summer, it tends to get hot. The next hatch is a super hatch, and it's the white fly. It's the Housatonic's probably most famous for the alder or zebra caddis because it's a semi-unique hatch that your average trout stream doesn't get. And the other one we're probably most famous for is the white fly hatch, which looks like an absolute blizzard. That typically used to start around mid-August and lasts about 2 weeks. It seems to be getting earlier and earlier, and in the last few years, it's been starting the very end of July. I don't know if that has something to do with natural flow or what, global warming, I don't know. But that's about a size 12. It's a white-colored mayfly that hatches right before dark in absolute profusion. I mean, when I say it looks like a snowstorm, I am not exaggerating. You start seeing a few around 7:30, 8 o'clock, and you see more and more and more, and they're flying upstream. And as it gets after 8 o'clock, you just see millions of them flying upstream. And then they eventually start hitting the water sometime between 8 and 8:30, and the spinners, I believe they molt in the air. And they fall in the water, and sometimes, without exaggeration, in a square foot of water, there could be 200 to 300 of them. The problem becomes getting them to see your fly. You know, a lot of times what we'll do is we'll put on a big white wall flight, like a 10 or even an 8, and then trail a cream or a white spinner behind it in a matching size, which would be a 12, maybe a 14. Sometimes we also use the usual in a cream color for that hatch. It's a sight to see, even if the river's too hot to trout fish, which it is some years. It's absolutely spectacular. If it's too hot, then the smallmouth will feed on it. If the water temps are in the mid 70s or below, the trout will feed on it. And it's a spectacle to see. I mean, it's absolutely insane.
Cool. Yeah, wonderful sight and presents new challenges. Yeah,
and as we
are always tough.
As we move into August, at some point, usually around mid-August, you start getting some cooler nights. And when that happens, usually you'll see a few Isonychia throughout the summer. We get some Isonychia in June, pretty big one. They're probably, a size 8 or a 10. I've maybe even seen them as big as a 6. The real Isonychia hatches that produce some of the best dry fly fishing happen more so latter part of August, September, to mid-October. It's about a size 10, could be a 12. It's a nice hatch. It comes off in the afternoon, you know, mid to late afternoon to be the most common size time. It produces some exceptionally good nymph fishing with an Isonychia nymph imitation or a prince nymph. Some days they want it dead drifted. Some days they want you to strip it in like a streamer. You have to let the trout tell you. You can blind fish big dry flies for that, or you can fish the fish that are rising. And that is another hatch I would consider a super hatch, and it's one of my favorite hatches. We actually had absolutely spectacular action last year. The river cooled off about a week into August. We started getting some nights into the 40s, dropped the water temp right down to the 60s. The trout turned on like somebody flipped the switch, and we had absolutely spectacular trout fishing in August, September, and October, to both dry flies and nymphs. And that was one of the hatches that drove that fishing. And it doesn't take very many of them on the water to get the trout on them. I learned that the hard way a bunch of times. My buddy would see one or two, and he'd put one on, and he'd just start pounding the trout. They get acclimated to it, and they like to feed on that hatch. You'll also start seeing sometime in August and definitely into September is what I call a fall sulfur. I think it's actually like Heptagenia hevi, I think is the Latin name for it. It's about a 16 to an 18, kind of a sulfur-colored mayfly. You could pretty much use the same patterns that you'd use for a spring sulfur. That's typically in the evenings, and you'll get a spinner fall. It's pretty fast and furious right at dusk to dark. A lot of that fishing in August and the first part of September is in that last hour. And the closer you get to dark, the more frenzied it gets. As you get into September, at some point you'll start seeing some olives. And by the time you start getting toward late September, peaking in October and going usually into early to mid-November until it gets really cold, you'll get some major league olive hatches. And they'll run anywhere from an 18 to a 26, occasionally smaller, with a 22 being a pretty common size. There's probably five or six different species that make up that hatch, hence the diversity of sizes. Typically, you don't have to go smaller than a 22 or 24, and often, even though they might be a 24 or 26, I'll start out with a 20 or 22 and a trout will eat it. And if they're picky, then I'll go smaller. That's probably the last major fishable hatch that creates dry fly fishing. I have sometimes in November and in December seen some good midge fishing, especially if you get some nice mild weather.
Okay. Well, let's we have some questions, and after you've gone through that litany of hatches, it's like, well, you know, it's almost impossible to discuss flies because you have to have a lot of flies. But I'm sure there's some common, and especially from the nymphing standpoint, some common flies that you use. Alan or Lane wants to know what your top five nymphs are for the Housatonic.
Top five nymphs. Okay, well, definitely right off the top of my head, the first two would be a golden stonefly and a prince. Those are 12-month-a-year flies. They work for trout. They work for smallmouth. The river has an insane biomass of golden stonefly nymphs. And when I say golden stonefly, I'm pretty much including any larger stonefly that has a yellow underbelly and a brown to mottled to black back on it. And, you know, they can, typical sizes I'd fish in that would be in high water, maybe as big as a 6 or even a 4. Probably 8s and 10s would be the most common sizes. You can fish them down to 12s and 14s, especially as you get toward late summer, early fall. You flip rocks, you'll find they're smaller. As you get in the spring, as they get close to the emergence time, which is like late May and June, you'll find they're bigger. And I'll also choose the size depending on water clarity. Higher murkier water, I'll go up a size or two on the fly. Lower and clearer, I'll go down a size or two. But those work year-round. When there's caddis hatching, it's hard to beat a LaFontaine deep sparkle pupa. I actually like that one with the bead head. I just dead drift it, especially in the mornings.
Yeah, I love that fly.
Absolutely deadly.
Up on the bighorn quite a bit, too.
Mm-hmm. I like the what they call the ginger or the tan version of that, and I like the green version of that. Those would be my favorite two, and usually 14s and 16s will do the job with that. With the prince nymphs, probably my go-to is a 10, but I carry them with me from a 6 to a 20, and depending on, again, on the height and clarity of the water, I'll go bigger. If it's the time of year when there's a lot of hatches and a lot of bugs are at maximum size, I'll tend to fish a little bit bigger, or maybe I'll fish it in the sizes of the bugs. It makes a good Isonychia nymph. It passes as a dark-colored stonefly. It functions as an attractor. You know, if you were going to fish this time of year, I haven't done well imitating the early season stoneflies, but you could put a big golden stone up front and then drop maybe a size 14 prince behind it to imitate the early season stones, and you know, you may find that to be effective. Top five. What other ones? I'm a big fan of the fox squirrel nymph. I've had very good luck with that fly on the Housatonic and a lot of other rivers. I think it passes as a lot of things. That's another one. I carry that from a 6 to an 18. My go-to is a 10.
Yeah, somebody, maybe it was Davey Wanton that was talking about that as one of his top flies recently, I think.
Could be. He's good buddies with Dave Whitlock. Dave Whitlock invented that fly.
Yeah.
So it certainly could have been him. That's a great fly. And the bigger sizes, I think you could pass for a small crayfish. A juvenile crayfish. It could pass as a golden stonefly. It could pass as a March brown, a gray fox, a Cahill nymph, a sulfur nymph. Lord knows, probably a caddis. Yeah. I've had very good luck with that fly. And I've caught a lot of big fish on it.
Since you mentioned crayfish, we had a question from John Guthrie in Kentucky. He asked specifically about, do you prefer crayfish imitations to be tied with large claws in a defensive position or small claws as in one that's fleeing?
Definitely small claws. I mean, in my mind, there's two types of crayfish patterns. There's ones that are for dead drifting, and I would tend to use one that's a little more realistic for that one, although I don't go crazy. I don't think you need to imitate every little minute detail. And then there's ones that you're going to strip and fish more like a streamer. And those ones you want to emphasize impressionism and motion. You know, use things like rabbit strips. But no, I don't think you want to, I don't think in general you want to have big claws. I mean, my own experience and everything I've read tells me that the trout seem to prefer the ones with smaller claws. I know the male crayfish are more aggressive, have larger claws, and they're more apt to face down with a smallmouth or a trout. The females and the juveniles tend to turn tail and flee, and they have much more smaller claws. And I think they're probably easier for the trout to catch and eat without a bunch of fuss. I discovered something very interesting a year or two ago in the fall. It was September, and I was fishing on the Housatonic in the evening, and I fished till dark, and a friend of mine that often fishes after dark there by the name of Streamer was a local guy who's a very good bamboo rod builder and an avid Housatonic fisherman and a very good angler. And he started flipping rocks in the shallows. And I'll be damned if every rock that was the size of a golf ball or bigger didn't have one or more juvenile crayfish on it. Oh, maybe the length of the last joint on your pinky. And I picked them up and looked at them. And I'd always done well in the month of September dead drifting really big hare's ears and foxquill nymph, like 8s and 10s. Now, typically, September is some of the lowest flows of the year. Intuitively, you would think you'd be using your smallest nymphs of the year, but my own experience was that while, yes, sometimes small nymphs worked well, I did really well with big fox squirrels and hares ears. And when I looked, the claws in the juvenile crayfish are very small, and they kind of tucked behind them a lot of times. And I said, you know, that looks a heck of a lot like a hares ear or a fox squirrel nymph. So I would say I like small claws on the pattern in general.
Okay, great. Well, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about some flies, maybe get into some smallmouth flies and so forth. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Do you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod-making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod-maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Tori Collins about the Housatonic River. If you'd like to ask Tori a question, just go to our homepage and askaboutflyfishing.com. And use our Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Let's talk a little bit about, well, I'll lead into the smallmouth here, some of the flies you're using for smallmouth. Mike Wolf asks, he's from Williamsport, Pennsylvania, do you find many flies that are top producers for both bass and trout?
There is quite a bit of overlap between the two. I would say the clearest distinction in my mind is probably that on average you want to use bigger flies for the smallmouth. They definitely seem to prefer that, and especially if you want to get past the smaller smallmouth and get into some of those bigger ones. Like I said, I mean, my favorite way to get smallmouth, I like to toss 4-inch, 5-inch long streamers at them. They're usually pretty aggressive on them in the summertime when the water gets warm. As a matter of fact, the hotter the river gets, the better the smallmouth bite. Some flies that I've had pretty good crossover luck with both species, those two nymphs I mentioned, the fox squirrel and the stonefly, work quite well for both. Woolly buggers in brown or olive are very good flies for both, and I'll often, especially for smallmouth, I'll often dead drift them, just like a nymph, either with an indicator, without an indicator. That's one of my, you know, go-tos when the fish is slow for smallmouth. I'll just put a size 6 or 8 brown woolly bugger under an indicator and dead drift it, just like I'm trout fishing. And that can work when the fish don't really want to chase a streamer. Clousers are great on smallmouth. They work quite well on trout. If you want to overlap the two, stick with more natural colors like white zonkers, natural zonkers, both the trout and the smallmouth like that. Yellow is an exceptionally good smallmouth color, and at times is also very good on trout, especially on the browns in the fall. That's a very good color. You know, I would just say if you want to overlap the two, just stick with the more drab or natural colors. You know, don't go too big, don't go too small.
Okay, you mentioned the Clouser as a streamer that you enjoy using. As far as smallmouth particularly, are there other streamers that work well for you and what colors?
Sure. You know, like I said, the Clouser is great for smallmouth. Chartreuse, or, you know, chartreuse and white, chartreuse and yellow, all chartreuse. Another variation they call Sculpin, which is basically brown over kind of like an orangey yellow, is excellent. I suspect because it also resembles the colors on a crayfish. Zonkers are excellent in a variety of colors. Natural and white would be go-tos. I'll tie a lot of just basically, rabbit leeches. Just a rabbit strip, a zonker type tail, pommered up the hook. I usually put a cone head on them. I tie those in just about every color and I like to tie them big. You know, like I said, about 4 inches on the average for smallmouth. Chartreuse is my number one color in that. I also have very good luck with brown, olive, white. I think I mentioned yellow, and black is good. You got to play around with the colors. I find just in general, the streamers, whether you're talking trout or smallmouth, you got to play around with the colors. And at any given moment, there's often one color that will work better. I find that the smallmouth to be very color sensitive also.
How often, what time frame would you switch up? If you've been using a chartreuse for, how long would you use it before you switch?
If I'm smallmouth fishing, if you're smallmouth fishing in the Housatonic, and let's say you're fishing at prime time, say, you know, mid to late June through September, say, when the water temps are warm, that's when they're most active. Like I said, the warmer the better. You know, they bite good at 70, they bite better at 75, they bite insanely well at 80. Remember that you're fishing over a lot of fish in this river, so if you're not catching fish, you need to change. I would say I probably wouldn't spend more than 10 or 15 minutes without changing colors. Probably no more than 10 minutes if I'm fishing for smallmouth and I'm not hitting them.
Okay, good. Let's talk, because I know you really enjoy nymphing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk for a bit, because we're getting close to the end here. And I want to spend as much time as we can here talking about the European styles, because you're hot on that now, aren't you, Tori?
I am.
Can you delve into that as much as you can here and tell us what the concept there is and the strategies that you use and what's working well for you? We did have one question that came in, but somebody was asking about, you know, how do you do the European or Czech style nymphing successfully? He says mostly he catches the bottom more than anything else. Why don't you enlighten us a bit here in the next few minutes?
Well, it was bred out of competitive fishing where they had rules that didn't allow them to use, you know, floating strike indicators and split shot on their line. So basically what I would consider I would call it Euro nymphing because it encompasses Czech, Polish, French, Spanish. Some of those use long leaders, some use short leaders. It's basically, for the most part, short line fishing with weighted flies. It's a highly tweaked form of high stick nymphing, basically. That's oversimplifying it. You're typically using 2 to 3 flies. They're weighted. You're not using split shot. You're rigging them on tag end droppers, you know, as opposed to tying them in line like most people do when they strike indicator nymph, where you tie one fly on, then you tie your tippet to the hook eye or the hook bend and you run it off that. On this one, you're tying either a blood knot or, say, a triple surgeon's, which is what I prefer, and you're leaving one tag end, you know, maybe 4 to 6 inches long, and you're tying droppers. And the weight of the flies is taken to the bottom. You're fishing a semi-taut line. Ideally, you're fishing a rod that's at least 10 feet. Some of the Europeans, the top Europeans especially, are using 11, even 12-foot rods.
And that's primarily to get your reach. Right?
It gives you better control over your drift. It helps you keep line off the water. It helps lengthen your drift. I think it helps with your hook set. It helps playing the fish. It cushions the fish from breaking off. It's a better shock absorber being a longer a rod, and it helps keep the hook in their mouth. The trend has been toward lighter and lighter rods. When this technique was first introduced into competitive fishing, I think it was maybe in the late 80s, they were probably using 6 weights, and over the years, the length of the rod has gone up and the line weight's gone down. I'd say most of the guys that are doing it aren't using anything more than a 4-weight now, and a lot of them are using 3 weights. We're actually carrying Graves is owned by Hardee's. We're actually carrying 10-foot 3/8, and those are selling because it makes a really good specialized rod for the Euro-style nymphing. There's no need, because you're not really doing a lot of traditional casting, you're basically flipping your leader out there, there's no need for, you know, a 5 or a 6/8 line to flip over, a 60-foot cast with a big bushy strike indicator and split shot. The rod functions as a means of controlling your drift and a fish playing device. The casting qualities become less important in this. I'm using a 10-foot 4/8 mostly. I find that very comfortable. I'm going to add a 10-foot 3/8 in. Some of my friends are playing around with 11-foot 3/8, and I know one of the companies we deal with, they're going to be coming out with a 12-foot 4/8 next year. So there's some interesting developments.
And, describe to me how, you know, you're approaching the river. What kind of water are you looking for this type of nymphing? And you know, what exactly do you do?
Okay, this type of fishing is probably at its best in water that's anywhere from medium to fast, shallow to medium. If the water is slow or deep, or it's really flat and smooth where you can't get moderately close to the fish, it's not going to be the best method. You're going to be better off using a strike indicator. The ideal, easiest situation is when you can approach the fish relatively closely. You would typically position yourself roughly about across from your target zone. Most of the actual fishing phase is above you and to you. You might let it come a little below you. You don't let it typically swing way around. The classic Czech or Polish style involves a short cast. It's basically your leader and maybe a few feet of fly line, with the leader typically for them being anywhere from maybe as short as 6 feet to maybe as long as 12. You're flipping it upstream and across. You're keeping your rod tip downstream of your line. You're leading it. Now, you said somebody sent in a question and said they were mostly catching bottom. I suspect they're using flies that are too heavy. When we started doing this, we were using 3 flies that we'd crammed as much lead and tungsten beads in as we could, and we've all progressively lightened our flies up, so we're just maybe occasionally touching bottom. A lot of times I'm not even on bottom. I'm just near it, and I'm gently leading my fly. Ideally, I like to have a slight bow in my line. So you're basically keeping the slack out. So you have a semi-taut line, and you're keeping pace with your flies, following it downstream. And once your flies get across or maybe slightly below you, usually you're terminating your drift then and making another cast. And the true European style would be you fish a fixed length of line, and you just move with your feet, and you cover the water like that. And they often refer to as combing the water, because they'll make a cast, they'll step out a foot, they'll make another cast, and they'll literally like almost comb the water in short downstream drifts. And if you watch videos of them doing it, a lot of times in the faster water, their drifts literally last 3 seconds, you know, and maybe encompass 5, 6, 7 feet, and then they're plopping it in again. And you get a lot of reaction strikes. A lot of times you'll find you're doing this, and the fish hit within the first 1 or 2 seconds. And the beauty of this technique is you have a taut line from the second your fly hits the water. So your fly is fishing, you're in touch with it, and it's highly likely you're going to detect the strike, where with an indicator you often have slack, and it may take 2, 3, 4 seconds for your drift to set up, and any take that happens early, the fish is probably going to grab it, hold on to it for a second or two, and eject it, and you will never even notice the take. I fished on a tailwater the last couple days, and most of the guys were having very slow fishing, and I was catching fish at a pretty good clip. And I think the difference was, I think they were getting bites, but I think with an indicator they weren't detecting them. And because I was fishing with a taut line, but still getting a pretty natural drift, I was detecting the takes. And as sensitive as this method is to strike detection, and I think that's its strongest point, is strike detection, the takes were super subtle. It was either just your line hesitated or slowed, or it just slightly stopped, and you'd lift up and bang, you'd have a fish on. To enhance the sensitivity, you're always using some kind of a strike indicator when you're nymphing, even if you think you're not. You're either watching the junction at the end of your fly line, you're watching where your line enters the water, you're watching a strike indicator. We're typically tying in what they call a sighter, you know, S-I-G-H-T-E-R. And all it is a piece of colored line. It could be red or chartreuse amnesia. It could be golden strand. It could be chartreuse or orange fly line backing. Look, I like that. I like to tie two pieces about maybe 9 inches together, one chartreuse, one orange, put a loop in either end. And you tie it in to your leader. Usually you have some short butt section. Go into your sighter, and then you have a long piece of tippet and forming a dropper connection, and then you have a fly below that. And then maybe if you have a third fly, you might have a dropper there. and you'd have another fly below that. If you have three flies, your heavy fly typically goes in the middle. They refer to your heavy fly as your anchor. If you have two flies, you typically would put your anchor fly in the bottom and your lighter fly up top. I don't know, in the rivers like the Housatonic and the Farmington that I fish a lot, I'm running probably 5 to 7 feet of straight tippet, like 4 or 5X from between my upper fly and my sighter. And I'm playing around with much longer leaders now. As I mentioned, the Czechs and the Poles use leaders that are anywhere from maybe 6 to 12 feet. We're using leaders that are 20, 25, 30 feet. And I know that sounds a little crazy, but a lot of times we don't have the whole leader out. A lot of times my finger is touching mono. I might have 15 or 20 feet of leader out beyond my rod tip. And then I have my finger on monofilament, which is probably a little more sensitive. And then if I need to reach out, if either the fish are a little spooky and I can't get closer, or I can't physically wade out any farther, or the water's deeper, it enables me to fish some lies and some spots I couldn't fish if I had a 10-foot leader. It's very versatile. You can pull it in, and now you have a short leader. You can extend it out, and now you have a long leader.
Now, when you're doing this type of nymphing, are you primarily sight fishing? Are you primarily blind fishing? It seems like you're going to be...
98% blind fishing. You can sight fish like this. You certainly could. But like I said, the type of water it lends itself to being most effective is if you can get moderately close to the fish. And usually the type of water where you can get close to the fish isn't the best sight fishing water. But yeah, we have done some successful sight fishing using this technique.
But it sounds like with this technique, even in a blind situation, you're getting a lot of coverage because you're down, you know, you're putting it down, picking it up quickly, putting it back down, picking up quickly, and working the whole water.
In water where you can wade relatively close, you can cover the water thoroughly and very quickly. You know, the Europeans, when they do these competitions, they have a 3-hour window of time, and they might have 100, 200 yards of water. Typically, the streams they fish aren't big. Let's say they have 200 yards, you know, and the stream's 30 feet wide. They have 3 hours to extract as many trout as they can, so they have to be very thorough and efficient. And in some of these countries, like the Spanish are one of the ones that use these super long leaders. Part of the reason being that, you know, they're fishing over wild fish that get fished over and are spooky, and these people keep the fish in a lot of these countries. Catch and release hasn't really caught on in Europe to the degree it has here. So in a section of American trout stream here 200 yards long, we might have, let's say we have 100 trout. They might have 5 trout. So these guys have to find those 5 trout. So they're very thorough about covering every nook and cranny because they never know where those 5 trout are going to be. And when they come over here, they have a field day with the density of trout we have in our streams.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds very interesting. Now, so you had to develop a new fly tying techniques and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you can fish traditional Czech and Polish style nymphs. The Czech nymphs are typically tied on a scud hook, anywhere from maybe a 6 on the big end down to a 16, and they usually have a back that's darker. You can make it out of thin skin or scud back. And then they have, you know, a dubbed underbody that usually has an under rib of tinsel or wire. Usually has a darker thorax. Sometimes in between the abdomen and the thorax, there's a couple of turns of brightly colored dubbing, like fluorescent orange or hot pink. They call that a hot spot. Sometimes the flies are drab, and then they pull the back over, and they rib it in place with usually monofilament or wire. The Polish nymphs are woven out of floss or yarn, usually with a dark back and a light belly. You don't have to use those flies to do it. They do work, and they do work well. But you can take your favorite flies, your prince nymphs, your stone flies, your hare's ears, your pheasant tails, slap a tungsten bead on them, incorporate some thin lead wire into the body. And what I do is I, rather than having a light, medium, and heavy version of each fly, I just vary the sizes. And on the bigger sizes, I put more lead and bigger beads. And on the smaller sizes, I use thinner lead and a smaller tungsten bead. And that way I just know visually from looking at it. I mean, typically when I want lighter weight flies, I usually want smaller flies. And if I need to deliver a small fly into heavy water, I can put on a big heavy fly and then also put a small fly in the rig.
It sounds like after you do this type of nymphing for a while, you'll be more sensitive to your other types of nymphing when you're using an indicator. Because like you say, you probably get more of a feel for when those takes are and how subtle they are, and you realize how many fish you're missing when you're fishing with an indicator.
It was a real eye-opener for all of us when we started doing this because we all rapidly came to the conclusion that, oh, my God, I bet you we're missing at least half the takes when we're indicator nymphing, maybe more. Maybe more. It really is an eye-opener. I mean, I don't know what the percentage of strike detection of this method is, and it would depend on the individual. But I suspect the strike detection is, if you're proficient at it, it's probably 80, 90%, maybe even better. And the Europeans actually often do a hook set at the end of each drift, especially the short line techniques. They'll drift it, and when the nymphs come about alongside their body, if you keep leading them, you're going to start pulling it in an arc, and you know it's going to pull out of a straight drift line. So a lot of times what they'll do is they'll turn their palm up, and they'll do a little hook set toward them, and that kind of pops the flies up, and they'll flip it back. And when I remember to do the hook set at the end of the drift, I bet you 10, maybe even 20% sometimes of my fish come on that blind hook set. What had happened was a fish followed your fly, grabbed it, drifted back with it, and even though your line's taut, you never detected it, and you set the hook, and bang, your rod doubles over. And sometimes you do the hook set, nothing, and then a half second later, you get a whack. You know, all of a sudden, the fly darts, and the fish comes and nails it.
Well, that tip alone is worth the whole show right there, I think.
Well, I can't take credit for that. The Europeans invented that one.
Yeah, well, that's all right. You know, it's just knowledge sharing. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, you know, it's funny. I used to guide for steelhead in upstate New York right out of college, and if you did that steelhead fishing, you'd get run off the river because that would be considered a snagging technique.
Yeah.
But you know what? When I do that for the trout, I have yet to foul hook a trout on that blind hook set at the end of the drift.
Usually in their mouth.
To tell you the truth, another way I know that I'm detecting more of the hits is I hardly ever foul hook fish using this technique. A lot of times when you're using two flies with an indicator, you'll foul hook fish on your bottom fly, which inevitably means it took your top fly and you set the hook late.
Mm-hmm.
Very infrequently happens with the Euro-style nymphing.
Very interesting. Well, Tori, we've run out of time, but we've covered a lot of ground, and hopefully folks have learned a lot during the show, and time goes by quick, doesn't it?
Boy, it did. It seemed like about a half an hour.
Well, we got to wrap it up, but stick with us here, folks, because we're going to be giving away that three-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion, and, of course, the dozen of Tori Collins' favorite trout and smallmouth bass flies. So stick with us here, and we'll do those drawings in just a minute. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and a support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can help support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or call them at 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Before I move on, there was one thing that I forgot. There was a question, Tori, on the internet, and then also Kristen Rillen in New Jersey asked, she said she hears the acronym TPO a lot. So what is TPO, and why don't you give that website again for the person that asked?
Oh, TPO, that stands for Trout Predator Online, and that's one of our guides, Aaron Jasper. That's his website that I mentioned before, and it's troutpredator.com. And if you want to know more about Euro nymphing, go on the forum there, and there's a wealth of information, and people can ask questions on there.
Terrific. Thanks, Tori. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, it's time now to give away our prizes, and the winners from our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late, but make sure you do so for the next show. You don't want to miss out on your chance to get some of these great prizes that we give away. If you are the lucky winner, we will contact you after the show and provide you with the information on how to receive your gift. So, first, we're going to give away a three-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and to learn more about the FFF, go to www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. So, we will do our random selection here, and the winner for the three-year membership is Mark Power in Nova Scotia. Mark Power in Nova Scotia. So, congratulations, Mark, I'm happy for you, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy that membership. And then we're giving away 1 year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. Want to find out more about that magazine? Go to flyfusionmag.com. Flyfusionmag.com. That's a wonderful, very colorful magazine out of Calgary, Canada that I know all of you would enjoy and enjoy learning from. The winner for that is Mark Simpkins. Mark Simpkins in, it looks like, South Korea. Mark Simpkins in South Korea. So, Mark, congratulations. To both of you, congratulations tonight. I'm sure you enjoy your gifts. Well, now, thanks to Housatonic River Outfitters, we're going to give away a dozen of Tory Collins' favorite trout and smallmouth bass flies. He says he's slipping in a couple of his favorites in there, right, Tory?
Oh, yeah. I'm gonna slip in a couple of flies for the Euro nymphing there. The will probably be the infamous Vladdy worm tied out of a pink condom. That's always a popular one.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure they're going to be looking forward to that one.
Oh, yeah.
So, folks, here's the question. When we were talking about flies, Tory mentioned two flies that were his top two nymphs that he could use all season. What were those two flies? What were those two flies? So, Tory, what I'm doing here is they've got to fill out that form on the homepage there and submit their answer. Be sure you put in your name and your location there, otherwise we'll disqualify you. And so I'm checking here and seeing who will answer this. And the first person that answers it correctly will get your box of flies. Well, here we go. Now, tell me, Tori, if this is the correct answer. Eric Halloran in Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. He says, the Prince Nymph and the Golden Stone.
That's correct.
That's it. The first person won right away. Terrific. Well, congratulations, Eric. And you won't have to send those flies too far, only up to Massachusetts. That's
just about driving there.
Well, maybe you guys can meet on the river. So, anyway, great. Well, please, Eric, in that same text box, give me your address, contact information, so that we can have Tori send those over to you. And just put it in there and submit it again, and then I'll have that. So thanks, guys, for all for playing, and we appreciate that. And thanks for all the great questions tonight, both before the show and during the show. It makes the show just a lot of fun to do for both our guests and for myself as well. Well, Tori, thank you so much for being on the show tonight and spending time with us. Certainly was educational for me, and I'm sure it was for everybody else.
Well, thanks for having me, Roger. It was a lot of fun. That hour and a half literally flew by, just like you said it would.
Yeah, it does, and it always leaves us with more to talk about at some future date. So, and folks, Tori has encouraged me to talk with another one of his compadres out there. So hopefully we can put together a more extensive Euro-nymphing show here in the future, so I'll be looking forward to that as well. But thanks again, Tori, and again, we appreciate your time.
You're welcome, Roger. Thank you.
Our next broadcast will be on April 1st, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and in that show we'll be interviewing Rick Pasek, and our topic for the show will be entomology for still waters. Rick will tell you that knowing about the natural insects that the fish eat is the number one most important thing to learn to become a good fly fisher. So listen into our next show to find out everything you wanted to know about the bugs that live in still waters. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Platte River Fly Shop, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic Outfitters, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115 extension 2. That's 888-961-1115 extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.